So today we're moving into the scary areas of pointer analysis. Sensitivity and flow sensitivity. These are areas that, you know, from a theoretical point of view, they're maybe not that complicated. They're reasonably well understood, but it's the practical. The practical implementation that we still don't know a lot about. And so these are the areas that there is current research going on in. And they are a little bit more complicated than what we've seen so far. So I expect you to ask lots of questions if you don't understand something, and I'm prepared to go slowly. On the other hand, you know, this might be the area where some of my answers will be, I don't know. Like Patrick said, that, you know, sometimes that's the right answer. Just because, you know, what context sensitivity and flow sensitivity will bias. I think the two key challenges here are, one, trying to find ways to implement them efficiently. Okay, because this is where the analysis stops scaling, and so we need to find ways to make it keep scaling. And the other question that we still don't know much about is, you know, what do these extra sensitivities actually bias in terms of precision? And the reason we don't have much data for that yet is because of the scalability issue. Right, so we haven't had implementations that scale to big applications, so we don't have much experience on big applications. We have some, but you know, not as much as for some of the simpler variations of the abstraction. Okay, so hopefully you remember this example from last time and from Matt's talk. All right, so here we've got two objects being created. They're assigned to A and B, and then they're assigned to C and D. And what you'd like for the analysis to do is figure out that they're two distinct objects, that C points to one and D points to the other. And if you do the analysis that we've had so far, what you do is when you add in a flow through an identity method, is that the flow gets merged, and then it comes out, and you get both C and D pointing, or possibly pointing, to both of those objects. Right? So this is the kind of thing you'd like to fix, and context sensitivity is what allows you to fix that. So there's several different ways of doing context sensitivity, so we'll see some of those. Right? So the simplest thing you can do is to use call strings. And actually, back in 1981, there was a paper by Sharir and Tonelli that described two different approaches. And really, it's two different classes of approaches to doing context-sensitive interprocedural analysis in general. It wasn't about pointers. It was about context sensitivity in general. And the one approach was described as the call strings approach. People sometimes also call it cloning. And the other was the summary-based approach. So we'll see that one on the next slide. But so what you do with cloning is kind of pretend you were to inline the function. Right? So you know, you don't have to actually inline the code, but do the analysis as if you were to inline it. And so the idea is we take this function, the identity function, we make two copies of it, and then for each copy we generate separate versions of the abstraction. Okay, so this kind of goes back to way at the beginning on Tuesday when I talked about the abstraction for a variable, right? And at that point we just abstracted the variable p with a node with a p in it. And I said that you have to be careful because, you know, even though you think there's only one variable p, at runtime, there's lots of different variables p. Right? Every time you execute the method, you get a new p. You know, it comes into scope and then it dies out. And so there's actually lots of different p variables that are abstracted by that one node. So now what we're doing is refining the abstraction and saying, well, on some executions of the method, p will get, or in this case it's o, so on some executions it will be abstracted by this node, on other executions it'll be abstracted by this other node. Okay, and so you can do different refinements of the abstraction. In this case what we're doing is using the call site, so you know where in the program did you call the method from, to distinguish the different executions of the method. All right, so if I call it from L3, I'm going to use the L3 nodes, and if I call it from L4, I'm going to use the L4 nodes. Okay, and so now we're happy because this allows us to distinguish the two different uses, and we now get C only points to L1 and D only points to L2. Question? Okay.
What's the complexity on this?
So it increases by a factor of the number of calls that you have, or the number of call sites that you have. So you would go, if you were cubic before, you know, it depends on how you, you know, what the other choices that you make are, but if you were cubic before, now you'd go to quartic.
Isn't this doing something very similar to one CFN?
We'll see the comparison. Except that, so this is what a lot of Java people would call one CFA, but that we've kind of seen isn't the same as what the functional people call one CFA. And so I think I've been careful in my slides not to call it CFA, but so I'm calling it call strings. Okay?
Okay,
so at this point we just have the one call site, but you could generalize it to having multiple call sites, and so we'll see that in an example.
Things that flew, that could flow to that call site, we would have. So if ID here actually could have contained several things, or is that always uniquely determined?
I'm not sure.
I have had several types of methods that flow to ID.
Several types of methods that flow to ID.
So here we have ID
for two different cards.
Yes.
But if ID could have been something that didn't return, that wasn't the identity, but was a constant function.
Right. So you could still specialize.
So then I would have four specialized cases.
Right.
Okay.
No.
Or is ID unique?
If you called ID from four different places, then you'd have four different copies of ID.
What ID is?
Oh, so you're
call graph construction? Like if you had a...
or it seems as if you would have something that would blow up.
More than just simply inlining, so to speak. You would have to inline every single possible function that could flow to ID. So through
right.
Our misunderstanding.
Yeah. So.
Like if each of these calls could had two possible methods that could be executed from the call site, then yeah, you would have to do it for all of them. So yes. But if you weren't doing context sensitivity, you would still have the two. Right, so you're going from 2 to 4. So you're just blowing up by a factor of the number of call sites. Okay, so I just want to give you a high-level overview of the summary-based approach to context sensitivity, and we'll see it in a little bit more detail later on. So this is at a very high level, but what I'm trying to do here is I want to come up with some sort of black box summary, something that tells me, what it is that the ID method does. And, you know, for an identity method, I need some description saying that this is an identity method. And then I can take my summary and somehow plug it into my graph. Okay, and so, you know, this is intentionally hand-wavy, but, you know, this is basically how the summary-based approach works. So in order to use the summary-based approach, we have these challenges that come up. So we need to somehow figure out how to build this black box, you know, how to represent the effect of the ID method or of any method in general. So we want to precisely model all of its effects. So we want a model that captures everything that it would do to get the same precision as in the cloning-based approach. We need the abstraction or this black box, this summary, to be easy to compute, and we need it to be easy to instantiate, right? So, you know, one possibility would be, well, you know, we need some representation of what ID is, so let's just take the code of ID as that representation, right? And, you know, that's a fine summary, but, and it's probably cheap to compute and represent, but instantiating it back into the graph can get really expensive, right? Because you're not really saving yourself any work by having a summary. So there are pointer analyses that have tried this approach in subset-based analyses. The difficulty is that for a subset-based analysis, it's very hard to come up with a representation that fulfills these challenges. Basically you need to remember all the different effects that the function and any function that calls can have on the heap, and you pretty much have to reason about the order and how they can be repeated, and then you pretty much get to something that's very close to the original code. So these summaries tend to grow very large, and they tend to be hard to instantiate back into the graph, right? So there have been several attempts to use this for a subset-based analysis, but scalability has always been a problem, and it's still an open question as to how you can do a subset-based analysis with the summary-based approach. On the other hand, with an equality-based analysis, it's much easier to come up with such a summary, and a few slides later, I'm going to show you how you do that. And so for an equality-based analysis, the summary-based approach is actually leads to a very nice analysis that performs very well in practice. But for subset-based, for the rest of this talk, I'm going to focus on the cloning approach. Okay, so here's my crazy comparison slide with one CFA comparing the one call string with one CFA. So, we used to have just var union obj cross field giving us a points to set, and what we've added is this one call site. Over in one CFA, things are kind of hairy. So this call here, that's not the same as this call. This was the call that was there for flow sensitivity. So you could throw that away and do a flow insensitive one. The call that comes in one CFA, at least in Matt's slides, he added it to the end. So this call corresponds to this call that we added here. So So we're saying we're going to, you know, duplicate all the information for each call site. So then you still have the variable going to a set of objects. So in one CFA, you've got the variable going through this address thing. Eventually, you get to a set of objects. We still have this that didn't quite match up last time. But now, there is some representation of the objects and the fields of objects in terms of these environments that go, you know, for a lambda and a variable, they give you an address that then will map to an object. But the correspondence there is not totally clear. So it's not quite one, you know, it's not quite the same as one CFA, but you know, the adding of the call does happen in both of them. And everything else is a little bit different. And I didn't expand the address here, so because that would have just made it even more complicated.
Does the cross product bind
closely with an arrow or not? Is what you meant there lamb 5 arrow add?
Oh,
or is it lamb 5 cross product parentheses var arrow add?
I tried to put parentheses everywhere, but apparently I didn't.
I think you mean there that the arrow binds more closely than
that. What do I mean?
But you want?
But yeah. I mean, here does it matter?
Just assume that Cartesian product binds more tightly than arrow.
I mean, in terms of
the way to read this correctly is that Cartesian product.
No, yeah, he needs another set of
Cartesian
parentheses.
Cartesian product does
yeah.
bind more closely, that's why the parentheses needs
to be.
Else, but there, you need parentheses around the var.
Yes, he needs parentheses around the var to adder. Yeah.
In the one.
Yeah.
So now I agree.
But does it make a difference?
Yeah.
I think it does. Because it's a lambda times an environment, as opposed to lambda times a variable, arrow.
But if I have a lambda and a variable, I mean, I guess
one is richer than the other, so maybe it has more structure, the power set that you have.
Yeah, they're not isomorphic spaces. They're not isomorphic.
Okay, but in any case, they don't seem to
work well with. Okay, so sorry about that. So I didn't put the brackets in there.
I mean, one is polynomial, the other is exponential as an algorithm.
So, Yanis, I solved the problem. I'll show it to you.
Okay.
Here's the
take this
offline. But anyway, I am really glad that we're kind of getting these all sorted out. But I do have a bunch more slides. So, okay. So, I mean, you guys kind of foresaw this. You know, if I just have a single call site as my text, well, you know, I'm just delaying the problem. And so, you know, here's another example. In this case, my identity function uses another identity function to return its result. And, you know, as I said before, this seems a really contrived example, but it models what happens in real programs once you strip out all the other extra stuff. So, you know, this does actually happen, and it happens quite a lot. So now the problem is we've distinguished the two different calls to ID, but then when ID goes and calls ID2, there's only one call site that it calls it from, so we only get one clone of ID2, and we just get L5 on that clone. All right? And so the solution to this is to allow multiple call sites. So we kind of keep a call site history. So, you know, in our first call, we've got L3. And then when we call ID2, we remember that how we got to ID2 was we first did the call at L3, and then we did the call at L5. Okay? So once you go to two call site, you've increased your complexity by another factor of the number of calls. And you know, you can do this indefinitely, but you're going to start to grow exponentially in the size of these call strings, right? Because every the length of the call string, you're increasing your complexity by a factor of the number of calls. All right. So in general, you can have k call site sensitivity. So you're just saying, I'm going to remember the last k call sites on the call stack. It's exponential in k. How do you choose the k? Well, yeah. So you know, that's up to you. But getting an efficient implementation with a k bigger than, I don't know, 3 is not really doable today. So maybe someone will come up with a better way. Another approach, rather than limiting the length of the call string, is to say, well, you know, why don't I use the whole string, right? The whole call stack. Well, okay, so that's exponential, so getting that to work is going to be hard. But, you know, let's say you don't care. If you have recursion in your program, your call strings will eventually get infinite, right? Because, you know, you're going around as many times as you want. So, you know, even if you have a really fast machine, doing an infinite analysis is still going to take a long time. So an approach that has been used is to use the full call string, but any time you have a call site that is potentially recursive, so if there's a way to get back to that call site, you just ignore that call site and you don't add it into the string. And that guarantees you that the number of strings is going to be finite because you're not adding in anything that's in a cycle. So that's good, you know, that makes your analysis finite. It's still exponential, so you still have to have a nice implementation. And then you might ask, you know, how does the precision of this compare to your other alternatives? Well, you know, it kind of seems like you're doing call strings of arbitrary length, so it should be really precise. Is if you have a call graph where many or even all of your call sites are in a recursive cycle, right? So if all of your functions in your call graph are in one big strongly connected component, you're going to have no context anywhere, so you're not even going to be as precise as using one call string or one call site call strings. So intuitively, you know, kind of hand-wavy, C programs, they tend not to use recursion too much. So for C, this could work well. You know, for Scheme, there's probably a lot of cycles, I don't know, lots of recursion. Java, you wouldn't think of Java as a language where you use recursion all over the place. But because of dynamic dispatch and polymorphism, the call graph ends up being very, very cyclic. Part of that is due to things that are recursive, even though you might not think of them as recursive. Right? So for example, if you have a hash set in your program and you start storing hash sets of then things like the equals method or the hash code method ends up being recursive because calling it once will call it on the things that you store in the set. So there's a lot of recursion that just pops up that isn't, you know, it's not the kind of thing you'd think of as being recursive.
Group does not affect the precision. In C, there is many core in some group. So Y or four, that then that doesn't affect the precision.
So loops, yeah. Oh, calls in, inside loops.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're using just the static call site, so the place in the program where the call happens. So if you call it in a loop, you're not going to duplicate. I mean, you're just going to have one copy of that function. So if your question is about precision, you're right that you're not going to get the precision. You know, you're not going to distinguish the different calls of the function in the loop. If you're worried about efficiency, you know, the loop doesn't break efficiency. But, you know, it might be less precise than if you did it, change the loop into recursion, because then you could distinguish the different calls. Okay, so in practice, with typical Java call graphs, you get this one big strongly connected component that, you know, roughly half the methods in the call graph are in that one big component. And so, you know, this is not really giving you much precision because for a lot of call sites, you're just ignoring them. And this strongly connected component, there's not any one cause of it, right? It's not like there's one cycle where if I manage to somehow break that one call edge, I'd get rid of my whole cycle. It's like this big jumble of methods that all call each other. So I don't think there's an easy way to get around this.
So Henning, the question is not precise. And it seems to be suggesting that for the finite domain that you have, you cannot get a precise algorithm. But here's another way to actually construct a precise algorithm in the same finite domain that you have, which would be to visualize all possible preconditions in your domain for each procedure and just analyze the procedure under each of those preconditions. But that's another kind of exponential graph, probably much worse, even if you wanted to precise up to 2 or 3 levels of call size. That might be worth mentioning that, you know, there's another way to get a different kind of exponential graph which would be precise in the presence of inversion.
Right.
And I don't have any slides that do exactly that, although I have some that come a little bit closer, so we'll see those. When you do that, you kind of start to be closer to the summary-based approach, because your summary is... I'll get to it. Yeah. Okay, so back to cloning. Yeah, go ahead.
So the
yes?
In CFA, the call sites you're keeping around don't actually represent the top of the stack. They represent the most recently called functions, not the most.
Right. Okay, yeah.
With yours, are they representing the top of the stack? Or
they're representing the top of the stack.
Yes. So, yeah. And I'm not sure how that affects things. I guess if you wanted to keep the most recently done calls, you know, not the stack, then you would probably need to be flow sensitive, right? Because how do you know what you last called if you're flow insensitive? So anyway, I don't know, but there's something to think about.
Personal take on this. So loops and recursion, they are not fundamentally different things. Therefore, if we have an analysis that works well for loops but does not handle recursion properly or vice versa, I personally don't think that's basically an elegant analysis. But for practice, this is very important because people have different kinds of abstractions in their mind when they encode the analysis using loops or when they encode the analysis using recursion.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, so here's another problem that comes up even if you have very long strings of call sites. So here, think about wrapping an allocation in, let's say, a factory method, right? So once your allocation is in a factory method, what happens is every time you call that allocation, well, you're going to abstract that object with the same abstract object, L1, So you're not going to be able to distinguish these two objects. And, you know, oftentimes you would want to distinguish them. If you'd want to say, this object is different than this object. So you can say that A and B point to two different things. And this is not just for factory methods, right? So factories are one common pattern where you need this. But another common pattern is things like collection classes, right? If you have an array list, that array list allocates an array to hold the elements of the collection. And if you don't distinguish the different arrays in the different array lists, you're not going to be able to distinguish the different array lists. Because once you put an object into one of the array lists, it's going to get into that common array, and then you're going to be pulling it out of all your array lists. Okay, so this is another place where it's important to add context sensitivity. You know, if I just add call sites as my context, well, that doesn't help me because it just splits up the two green nodes. What I really need is a way to split up the blue node. And so, well, why don't I just do that, right? So now my object abstraction is no longer just the allocation site, but it's the allocation site plus the place where I called, the call site where I called the method that contains the allocation site. Okay, so I called alloc from L2, and then in L2 created the object by this blue node. Here I called alloc from L3, and I allocated the object at L1, and so I've got an object L3, L1. So now I can distinguish the two objects, and I'm happy. Okay? And again, I can generalize this in the same way with longer strings of call sites. All right, so no questions there. Comparison with one CFA. So here, really, Matt's not even here. Here I put the slide mainly to say that I have no idea how this fits into one CFA. And what I found strange is that one CFA doesn't appear to do this, although my understanding could be wrong. I'm going to leave this till afterwards. So the reason I find it surprising is that for Java, it seems to be very important to do this. And it looks like one CFA doesn't do it. But anyway, I'll talk to Matt about it after. Okay, so now if you're working with an object-oriented language, you might start to think about different things that could be your context abstraction, right? Remember, the context, you know, and we saw it in Matt's talks as well, there he phrased it as an abstraction of time, where time was, you know, which time you called the method, right? There's different calls to the method, and you're distinguishing them somehow, and you want to somehow group the different runtime calls into groups that you can reason about separately in the analysis. So, you know, where you called the function from seemed to be an obvious way of abstracting the context. But now, if you're an object-oriented programmer, you might think of other ways of abstracting, of distinguishing different calls of a method. And one of those things is, what object am I calling the method on? Right? You know, that if you're looking at object-oriented programs, that's an obvious way to distinguish different calls to the method. What object is the method being called on? And so that's what object-sensitive analysis tries to do. So instead of the call site, the context now is some abstraction of the receiver, the object that the method is called on. So it looks a lot like call sites, It's just that the abstraction is different. And, you know, because objects are runtime things, I need some abstraction. So I can go back and use my allocation site as the abstraction for the object. Okay, so what am I trying to do here? So this is the context-insensitive version. My example here is I've got two separate containers, and I can distinguish them. And then I've got two separate items, and I can distinguish those. And then I call, you know, some setter method or adding it to the collection. And I'd like to be able to say that one collection contains the one item and the other collection contains the other item. And here they get confused because, you know, I only have one copy of the set method. In this particular example, doing one call string context sensitivity would help. But, you know, for the sake of example, I'm going to do the object sensitivity. So here it is with object sensitivity. So what am I doing here? Well, so the L4, L5, this stuff is the same as before. I just moved it from up there to down here. But what I now have are two clones of the set method. So I've got the this variable and the I variable and another clone. But now this context is not where I called the method from. You'll notice I don't call the method at line 1 or line 4. The context now is the abstraction of the object on which I called the method. All right? So over here, I'm calling the method on C1. And I look at C1, and it's got an L1 in it. So it points to the object that's abstracted by L1. And so I'm going to add an edge to this node that is the L1 clone of that method. So anytime I call the set method on the object created in L1, I'm going to use this clone. Anytime I call the set method on the object created in line L4, I'm going to use this method, or this clone of the method. Okay, so, you know, is this more or less precise than one call site? Tricky question.
It's incomparable, but in practice it's always better.
You're not allowed to answer. Okay, yeah, but you're right. So, actually, you can find examples where, I mean, it is incomparable. So, in theory, you know, you can find examples where this works better or vice versa. In practice, this tends to model object-oriented programs better in the sense that, you know, if you limit yourself to one call site and one object, the objects are going to give you more precision in practice just because they can track okay, so if you think about object-oriented programs, you can have a chain of calls, and one call about the chain of calls that you came through, but if all those calls are the same object, you're going to get that information. And object-oriented programs tend to do that a lot. In practice, this does tend to give you better precision than call sites. Of course, you know, if you take, you know, k call site sensitivity for, you know, k equals 50 versus one object, well, you know, then it might not be a fair battle, and the call strings might work better. Of course, the call strings are going to be, you know, hopelessly exponential. So basically, for the same cost, you can get higher precision than with object sensitivity in practice. You had a question?
So the sensitivity approach with the context-sensitive approach. So the top of context- context sensitive, are you only distinguishing the call sites, or are you also distinguishing the arguments with which I'm calling them?
You're only distinguishing the calls.
And I mean, they're both of these are different variations of context sensitivity. So, and in fact, you could do a combination, right? You could do context where you keep both the call site and the receiver. In fact, you could go further and, you know, not only look at the receiver, but also distinguish the other arguments to the function. And there's a paper on that that's the Cartesian product algorithm. So, I mean, you can combine these object abstractions. The trick is finding combinations that are efficient yet precise. Yeah, I'm not sure if I answered your original question. Yeah, sure.
Through your examples, context is very, very defined as a, you know, through the objects that are calling functions at the time or something like that. There's many common objects through which you have static functions and static variables.
Okay, so you're asking about
that don't have a receiver?
Right, I'm asking about how do you in a sense with a global context of the program that...
Right, so...
You can just have, you know, one extra context that's the global one for when there is no receiver. Or if you want to keep extra information, you could just remember the last receiver that you had at the call site. So that might give you more precision. You know, when there is no new receiver to add, well, just keep the old one. So,
in general, my understanding is that this might be stressing a lot of the context sensitivity, just because you go to a global site first, you lose a lot of precision about the context.
Right.
But they're not used that much, right? I mean, most of the methods you call are not static. Only a small number of them are. So yes, you do lose precision on the static ones, but they tend not to be that common. Okay, so just like for call sites, you can extend this to strings of abstract objects as your abstraction. I was careful not to say here how exactly you do that, because there are different choices of, if you're going to allow yourself strings of allocation sites as your context to give more precision in describing abstract object that is your context, there's different ways to do that, and different people use different variations, and they all call them the same thing, and that's a debate that we've been having with someone should really describe this and come up with terminology for this. But anyway, so the point is, there's different ways that you can, once you go beyond one allocation site as your context for your abstract object, there's different ways you can construct the strings, but the point is you can construct longer strings for more precision. As well, you can make the heap abstraction context sensitive, just like we did with call strings. So your blue nodes, you also split them up with the same kind of context. Okay, so theoretically they're incomparable. In practice, object sensitivity works much better than call site sensitivity. And that's not the whole story. This slide summarizes a big study that I did comparing different variations of context sensitivity on a bunch of Java programs. And I looked at several different clients. So here I've got call graph construction and cast safety analysis. So, you know, call graph, I'm trying to get a precise call graph. Cast safety analysis, I'm trying to prove that a cast will never fail. So I can use that to remove the cast or to warn the programmer about casts that may fail. So if you look at building call graphs, context sensitivity doesn't buy you much in terms of precision. You don't get a call graph that's a whole lot smaller by having a context-sensitive analysis. There is some effect. You end up having more call sites that are singletons, that are monomorphic. So if you're, you know, if you want to use this for something like inlining, maybe context is a good idea, although people tend not to do much static inlining these days anymore because JITs do it anyway. But, you know, just in terms of if all you care about is a small call graph, context doesn't seem to help much. On the other hand, if you care about a property that's much more object-specific, much more kind of, you know, closely related to the pointers, like cast safety, their context matters a lot. And especially because Java programs tend to use collections. They put objects into collections, and without context sensitivity, once you pull it out, you know nothing about its type because, you know, anything else you ever put into a collection anywhere else could come out. So for cast safety, this context is very important in terms of precision. And you need context, but also on the abstract object. So you need that context-sensitive heap abstraction to get all the context to get all the precision. Once you've got that, strings doesn't seem to buy very much. Although I think if you went to really long strings, which is impractical, I think you would get precision. But really, you know, that first call site or that first in terms of context buys you a lot, and you know you'd have to go far to get much more. And you know, as I mentioned, big cyclic call graph. If you do that, you know, if I call it infinite call site. You let your call site strings grow as long as you want, but you throw out anything that's in a recursive cycle, that actually gives you much less precision than the alternatives, mainly because of this big strongly connected component. All right. Okay, so there's no questions about that. I just want to pause because I'm moving to something a bit different. Yeah.
I guess I have a question. Does moving collection classes to generic have any effect on this at all in terms of what you didn't have a collection?
No.
So, I mean, the generics, I mean, they're just a type annotation, so and they go away at runtime, but the analysis doesn't, you know, the analysis doesn't try to instantiate the types. So generics don't help for the analysis, although you could view the types as something kind of like context, right? And because when you instantiate the collection with a different type, so context sensitivity would distinguish the different instantiations of the collections. And whenever you instantiate the collection, you give it a type. So you could also distinguish them by type. I guess to say it a different way, one context abstraction you could use is the type that you instantiate the collection with. I think that would be less precise than object sensitivity, because object sensitivity distinguishes every single instantiation. Here you'd be grouping together instantiations with the same type. But, you know, it might be a good trade-off in terms of speed versus precision. So, yeah.
This has been published somewhere.
This study is in TOSIM recently. Sorry?
October
2008. Yeah, I mean, I know when I submitted it, right? But it takes for it to come out, so I don't remember when it finally came out. But yeah. So October 2008, Yannis says.
Right. Yeah, so if
the translation of generics actually did the cloning, then the analysis on the clone thing would have all the same context sensitivity, right? But then you'd be analyzing a much bigger program, so you're kind of cheating, right? So, I mean, I do all my analysis at the bytecode level, and most people do, because analyzing, the semantics of bytecode are a lot hairier than at bytecode, so most people do bytecode. Yeah, sure, I'll do this. Okay, so, so here's the example that I mentioned about summary based context sensitivity being a lot analysis. So the problem is we need a summary that accurately and cheaply captures the effect of calling a function, right? And for equality based, that's pretty easy because what the summary has to do is remember which things got merged together, and that's all it really has to do. Right? It doesn't have to remember flow between sets, just which things got merged together. So if we, you know, have this crazy function here, doing equality-based analysis on that, we merge the A with the D, then we merge that with the B, we merge E with C, E with A dot F, and E with the return value. This can be our summary. You know, and we can actually make it even smaller by throwing out any variables that are not visible outside the function. But, you know, this is our summary. What got what? Okay, so there's our black box. And so now, when we call this this function, summary, so at every, okay, so when we call the function, we can either instantiate that black box everywhere, it's not that big, so we can just make a copy of it, or, you know, we don't even have to actually make a copy in terms of data structures. All we're interested in is which things it's merging together, right? So we can kind of functionally make a copy just by saying, okay, merge A with B and merge C with ret and so on. All right, so now, if we have a place that calls it, I'm first going to process this store to x.f. So I look at x, it's got L1, so that's going to go to L1.f. So I merge that with this node for w. So now I've got L1.f might point to L4. I instantiate my summary here. And what I want to do is control the flow of parameters and return flows in for B, Z flows in for C, and the return value goes to V, right? The return goes to V. So I'm going to basically merge those nodes. And so now I've got, you know, this one big node for X, Y, and another big node for V and Z. Because I merged those nodes, I need to merge L1 and L2, and I need to merge L3,
becomes a L1, L2 dot F node. Similarly, yeah, okay. I do also want to merge. Well, yeah, not yet. Okay. So
I've got this A dot F node. RNZ can go to A dot F. I need to look at A.
To make an indirect edge connecting this to L1, L2 dot F. So I connect these nodes together. So now I have this big monster node that's got V, Z, and W in it. So now I'm going to have to merge L3 and L4 as well. So the point is that if I had another call to F, I wouldn't start merging those parameters with this copy of the black box. I just make another copy of the black box. And so that prevents the thing we saw before with all the objects getting merged into a single object because of the constructors. So you can kind of think of this as intra-procedurally, it's equality-based, but inter-procedurally, it has kind of a subset-based flavor. Not exactly, but you're not allowing flow from, from one call site to the procedure and then back to another call site. You know, that flow is restricted.
Go.
Okay? All right, so, and this works very well for C. So Lavner and Abbey use this
for their cache optimizations. So it works very well for C. For Java, not so much, again, because of the cycles in the call graph. Right? When you start applying these around a cycle, eventually you end up merging a lot of stuff. So what they do is figure out groups of objects that get access together, and then they will allocate them together. So they'll split all the mallocs to allocate in different pools of memory, and then things that are accessed together tend to be close together. Okay, so this is actually a paper from Ras Bodik, so who was here last week, and you know he should have talked about this, but he's doing sketching now. This is probably my favorite points to analysis paper, but it's very complicated. I really wanted to explain it, and I realized it would take at least an hour, and then you guys would get bored. So I'm just going to explain the gist of it. And if you're interested, you know, take the 2 hours that it takes to read it and really understand it, because it's a complicated algorithm, but it's a very cool algorithm. All right, but hopefully this gives you the gist. So what they're trying to do is, first of all, it's a demand-driven analysis. So they're not trying to compute all the points to sets. What they're trying to do is answer queries like, you know, does the point set of D contain L1? Okay, so they want to quickly answer individual queries of that form. And, you know, okay, so there's an obvious way to answer such queries. What you do is you get your pointer assignment graph, and if someone asks, you know, does L1 flow to D? Well, you go to D and you look at paths going backwards and you see if you can find L1. You know, or you could go the other way. All right. Well, okay, so there's a problem with that, which is your queries aren't going to be fast, right? You want your queries to be faster than having to search the whole graph every time. There's another problem, which is, you know, all this context sensitivity. So they end up getting, not just a demand-driven analysis, but a context-sensitive demand-driven analysis. Context-sensitive in the sense of call site strings, but of arbitrary length. All right, so how do they do that? Well, what they do is when you have a call, okay, the labels are on the wrong lines. They should be L1 here and L2 here. So when you have a call, the edge you use to model the flow into the call, you label it with a parenthesis. And then when you have the return from the same call site, you label that with another, with a parenthesis, with the same kind of parenthesis, right? So, these are for L1, and this is for L2. And then, since you're doing a demand-driven analysis, you're looking for paths in the graph. Well, once you find such a path, you can just check to see that the parentheses are balanced. And if they are, if they are, then you know that context sensitively, your abstract object is in the set. If they're not balanced, then you know that the contexts are wrong, so you should answer no, right? So, if I ask, is there a path from L1 to D? Well, yes, there is a path, but it's not correct with respect to context. So if I wanted context-sensitive information, I would say no, D does not point to L1, right? So you can do that because you have the path, and you can look at the path and check the parentheses. Okay, so now, how do you make this fast? So, yes, question.
Question?
My question was there are too many paths. I'm going to
right. So that's the cool part. That's the part I'm going to hand wave about a little bit. But there, I'll give you the general idea how to deal with the fact that there's too many paths to check the law.
All right, but basically, so your answering query is of this form, and the way you do that is by looking for paths with balanced parentheses. Okay, so how do you deal with the fact that there's too many paths, but there are lots of paths to search? Yeah, okay. So so the cool idea is what you do is you add shortcut edges to the graph. Okay, so you add a bunch of, you're always allowed to add edges, and that's sound but not precise. So you add a bunch of shortcuts, and that way there ends up being very short paths from the abstract objects to the different variables. Now, this is where I'm really hand-waving, because the exact method for adding the shortcut edges has to be just right. Right? So you have to add the shortcut edges in a way that makes they're actually okay. So the idea is that when you have the shortcut edges in there, you always want to take a shortcut whenever there is one, because if you try the shortcut and then you try all the other paths, that doesn't help you. That doesn't help you with the number of paths that there are. Adding the shortcut just adds paths. So the idea is whenever you see a shortcut, you always take it. Or if there's multiple shortcuts, you take all the shortcuts. But if there's a shortcut, you never try the real path. But then, of course, you have to put in the shortcut edges in a way that you're still going to be able to get to all the places that you would be able to without the shortcut edges. So that's where the tricky part comes in, and that's where you have to read the paper and really understand it. But the point is, if I can't get from my object to my pointer, even with those extra shortcut edges in there, then I'm not going to be able to get to it when I get rid of the shortcuts again. So I can very quickly answer no to queries where the answer is no. Right? And so that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to, very quickly answer most of the queries, but then when the queries need more information, when they need to explore more contexts, they want to go and explore those in more detail. And so the way they do that is once you find a path that uses some of these shortcuts, you go and remove the shortcuts on that path, and you one at a time, right? So you find a path, it's using a shortcut. Well, you know, I want to see whether that shortcut is really valid, right? Whether it's okay to really be taking that. So you remove the shortcut and you see if there's still a path left without that shortcut. But the cool thing is that you only need to remove the shortcuts on the path that you found. Okay, so the high-level idea is that once you add the shortcuts, the paths are shorter and there's a lot fewer of them, and then you remove shortcuts but only on the paths that you're really interested in. And yeah, I think for more details I'll have to refer you to the paper. But anyway, it's a really cool paper. I really like it. Okay, so that's all I had to say about context sensitivity. You know, there's a lot left to be said and a lot of research to be done on context sensitivity. I don't have too much on flow sensitivity, so I'll go through that, if that's okay. All right. Okay, so everything we've been doing so far has been flow insensitive. Flow insensitive meaning we've completely ignored the order in which all the instructions are executed. Okay, so you know, here's an example. Here's the graph for it. We flowed the points two sets, and yeah, okay. So you know, so far nothing new. But you know, if you look at these instructions, you might think, well, why don't I look at the order in which they get executed? And you know, I could keep points two sets at every program point. Right? So, you know, after I execute L1, I've got A points to L1. And, you know, I go through, and now at L4, I'm overwriting A with B. And so, you know, the old value of A doesn't matter anymore. It's gone. I'm overwriting it. So at this point, I could say, well, you know, now A should point to L2 and no longer L1. Right? So this is what a flow-sensitive analysis would do. It would have possibly different answers at every program point, and it could do what are called strong updates. So a strong update is when you remove the old information from the set. In a flow-insensitive analysis, you can never do strong updates. If something is already in the set, you can't take it out because you're overwriting what's already there, because that information has to be valid both before and after you execute. But with flow sensitivity, you can do these strong updates where you you know, throw out what's already in the set. Okay, so but a problem here is that, you know, now I'd have to take my whole abstraction, all of my points two sets, and duplicate them for every point in the program. That's going to be really expensive, right? So you'd like to not have to do that. Well, okay, so what could I do? So here's a simple thing I could do. So I could notice that, you know, let's say I'm in line 5 and someone asks me, okay, what does A point to? Well, and you know, I'm at probably asking because I'm assigning to B. Well, you know, I can look backwards through the program and I can see, well, here I assigned to A, so it would have overwritten anything that was already there. So whatever A was way up here doesn't matter at this point, right? So my current value of A at line 5 is really the A that was created at line 4. Okay. So what I can do is I can number the... So I can keep track of which version of each variable is the current one at each point, and I can number number the actual variables. Okay. So instead of saying I'm now changing the points to set of A, I'm throwing out things from the old points to set, I can just say, okay, well, I'm moving to a different version of A. All Right? So, you know, I had A1 before and A4 now. I've got B2 and then B5 and then C3 and C6. And if I do that, I label all the versions. I also need to figure out which versions I'm reading. Then I can just do the same analysis that I had before on the version variables, and I'm going to get the flow sensitive result. Okay? And you know, it says SSA. Hopefully everyone or almost everyone has seen SSA before, and this isn't all that new. I'm not going to go into much detail on SSA. But the point is that for these local variables, just doing the flow insensitive analysis on SSA form gives me all the benefit of doing it flow sensitively. Of course, it only works for local variables. You know, it's not going to work for the yellow nodes, the objects, and the heap. Yes?
It's not clear to me that this gives you anything over flow sensitivity, because you're still having to do a bit of work to decide which variables to keep in your abstract store. And I mean, computing the SSA form in the first place is not necessarily trivial. Why would we want to do this?
I mean, if the alternative is to keep different copies of all the points to set for all the points in the program, you know, this is way more efficient, because you only keep a new, or you only make a new version of the points to set when the variable actually gets overwritten. So you, I mean, you know, here you have, you know, 6 times 3 points to sets, whereas here you only have 6. So it's a way of efficiently implementing.
Drop A1 and C3 and B2, though.
Sorry?
You had to do some work on the initial 3 variables there, A1, B2, and C3. That's the only reason that you are down to lower.
Okay, so
I'm not saying it's better than flow sensitivity. It's a way of implementing flow sensitivity cheaply and easily, right? You don't have to, if you do SSA and then you just do your flow insensitive analysis, implementation-wise, it's easier. But also efficiency, you know, if you didn't have SSA form, what you would need to do, going statement by statement, is to somehow try to keep track of, which points to set is current at this point.
Isn't that just and definitions analysis stuff?
Yeah, but it's so reaching definitions tells you which variables reach, but I mean, how do you translate that to, you know, which set am I supposed to be looking at?
Qualified a bit more. So if you're only talking about computing SSA on local variables, that's going to be pretty easy, because studies have shown that this can be computed in almost linear time, even though theoretically it takes quadratic time. But I use SSA all the time, and that has never been a bottleneck. But if you want to compute a precise SSA which is sensitive to aliasing itself, then it's like a chicken and egg problem, because to compute SSA, you need quantum analysis, and here we are using SSA as an efficient data structure for quantum analysis. But one way that I've seen this problem solved in some big compiler infrastructures is that you do it iteratively. You build one single SSA form, do pointer analysis, then you refine, you build another SSA form which makes sure the pointer analysis that you've computed, and you do this 2 or 3 times to get decent precision. This is one of the strategies that I've seen.
So
SSA if you want to try to do SSA for things that can be aliased, there are approaches, but it's still an open area. But if you're just doing SSA for local variables that haven't had their address taken, that's cheap. And then once you've got SSA, it gives you an easy way of getting the same effect as flow sensitivity for those local variables. I mean, I'm not saying anything about other variables. So I mean, it's yeah.
So in some analysis that I worked on, I've been able to prove theoretically better complexity results if you work on the SSA data structure. And in practice, I've seen that it helps a lot.
Right.
So I'm all for SSA.
Yeah.
SSA. Yeah. Okay. okay. And so now, if everybody knows SSA, this slide is redundant. But anyway, it'll be quick. So the point is that sometimes you don't know which definition of a variable is the current one. So here you've got two definitions of A, and then you merge, and now you read A, and you need to know which one you've got. And so what SSA does is it introduces this phi function, which is not really a function, but it depends on the control flow that came before. And what it does is creates a new definition of A that is a merge of the two old definitions. Okay, so this isn't a talk on SSA. I just put this here so you know that this problem can be solved, and SSA does solve it. For those of you who have never seen SSA, hopefully there's not too many such people. Okay, so when does flow sensitivity matter? I think the answer to that is we don't know. There have been some empirical studies kind of a long time ago on small programs when things were not very scalable. We don't have very much information about when it matters. These are just some of my thoughts on where it might matter, where it makes sense to be looking for ways that it might matter. If you want to improve precision for local variables, you don't need to do flow sensitivity because you can just do SSA and it'll give you the same answers. So, you don't have to go to the complexity of flow sensitivity. For local variables whose address has been taken, like in C programs, there's a place where it may make sense to do flow sensitivity, and it may give you improvements in precision. Over in Java land, you don't have those, so you don't get that. For global variables, it could matter, but it's not really clear. What do people use global variables for? They tend not to be the kinds of thing that you overwrite very frequently with completely different things. So I'm conjecturing that there it doesn't help you very much. And so now, fields of heap objects. So these are the yellow nodes in the analysis. So if you just look at it, straight as the points to analysis as it's formulated, the first thought is to say no, right? This is not going to change precision very much. The reason being is that you can't do strong updates on those yellow nodes. All right, so why can't you do strong updates on those yellow nodes? Okay, let me put that out as a question, right? Why can't you do strong updates on the yellow nodes? Okay, Matt knows.
Well, you could have multiple concrete counterparts to that.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. I guess I gave it away, right? So remember at the beginning, my abstraction was that the blue node represents any object allocated at that allocation site. And so the yellow node is for a field of a blue node. And there could be lots of different objects at runtime that are all abstracted by that same blue node. And so if I change the field of one of them, well, I haven't changed the field of the others. So I can't throw away the value that the field had before because the others might have that value. Okay? So as long as I have an abstraction where a single abstract object can represent multiple concrete objects, I can't do this. Right? I can't do strong updates. And strong updates are really what flow sensitivity buys you. I can do it for the light blue nodes, the address of nodes, because those are just taking the address of one thing, right? So here, yes. But for the dark blue nodes, unless I know that there's only one object, I can't do this. But now, you know, if I did know, if I were to be a little bit more open-minded and try to refine my abstraction so that in certain cases I have abstract nodes that represent only a single object, then for those I could do flow sensitivity and it could buy me some precision. Okay? So what's not likely to work is looking for allocation sites that get executed only once. You know, with the big call graphs and all the cycles in the call graphs, there's not going to be a whole lot of allocation sites where you can prove that. But what you can do is take techniques from so-called shape analysis. So shape analysis is, well, it's a form of pointer analysis that doesn't like to be associated with pointer analysis. It's basically a more precise variation, more costly variation of analyses that reason about pointers in more precise ways. And the big difference is that they do have abstractions that very often refer to individual objects. So, you know, if we can take techniques from those kinds of analyses, then we might be able to get something out of flow sensitivity. And there seems to be a trend of stuff like that happening. So there's been a number of papers, with titles like lightweight shape analysis, which you could think of as, you know, precise points to analysis, right? If you're just looking at it from the other point of view. So there does seem to be some migration of those kinds of ideas that, you know, could make flow sensitivity actually very worthwhile. So definitely still an open area, context sensitivity and flow sensitivity, lots of open questions, mainly on the practical side. Okay, so that's all I had to say. I guess I should stop here and take questions over lunch, unless there's quick questions right now.
So path sensitivity is kind of like more flow sensitivity, flow sensitivity of exposure, right? There are analyses that are path sensitive. Usually they don't I'm not sure how much they would buy you in terms of just
giving you more precise pointer information. I mean, they're very useful for certain applications where you also use pointer information, but would path sensitivity help you get more precise pointer information in the first place? I'm not sure.
So in other words, what I want to ask in all this analysis, you completely ignore the contents of conditions, because everything that you're building was coming
right
from assignments, right?
Right.
Now, in model checking, one other analysis is trying to reason about more functional topics of program. If you ignore the conditional, then what would that abstraction, the analysis would almost be useless.
Right.
But it looks to me, from the fact that this would be very useful, very scalable,
has been looked at a lot because, you want to be efficient. You want to handle big programs, and so path sensitivity, might be the next thing that is now going to become important, right? you know, I said for context sensitivity and flow sensitivity, you know, those are the areas where we don't really know yet how things will behave. And so I think once we know those, path sensitivity might be the next one. You know, just because of the cost, right? So, you know, once we get the as we get the cost down on the other things, you know, more precision becomes possible, and so then you can start studying how that affects things. So, yeah, I mean, it could well be that path sensitivity will be the next big thing after context and flow. So, it's when you start paying attention to the conditions that you encounter along your control flow paths. So, you know, if you have an if statement that splits the control flow, you actually look at what the condition was and try to reason about that. So, for example, if you have two if statements that do this and they have the same condition, you can now know that, you know, you can only do this or this, but not the other one.
Can actually occur.
Right.
But you're not reasoning about, based on that condition, I now know the variable is going to arrive here.
Well, I mean,
you could use that as well.
Program, you're not going to gain any information about the condition. It's very first conditional in your program that the main control flow meets, you're not going to gain any information. But you might use that conditional to gain information.
So you're correlating the information
conditionals. And I mean, once you're doing that, you could also use that information to refine your analysis, right? So if, you know, if I have a condition that says, you know, if x point, or if x equals y, then I know that x and y now point to the same thing. So, you know, you could start using that as well. Okay, so let's have lunch, and we can talk about it more at lunch or tonight or whenever.